Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. My wonderful audience, again, glad to be back with you. It's always good to know you're out there. Always good to know there are a lot of great people out in the world. Today, my guest is named Richard M. Everling. He's an amazing man, and I don't usually even try to start out with my guest's name, but he's going to be talking today about medicine, science, really the complete loss of ethics and science in medicine. This will be very interesting, to say the least. And again, it's Peter Breggin, and this is a wonderful show for you today. I think we're going to dig deep into what's going on in the world out there. And don't forget our book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators. It provides the background for so much of the disaster we'll be looking at today. Well, folks, this is Richard Amerling. He's sitting here across from me, somewhat across the nation. He's an interesting man. He grew up in New York City, had a lot of his schooling in New York City, and had his internal medicine in New York City, then went to New York Hospital in Queens, and then he went to the University of Pennsylvania, became a nephrologist on top of it all. And he's practiced in a variety of places. Most interesting to me, and to me his real credentials, are that when COVID broke loose on us and over the world, he had to make decisions like a lot of other people did. And he's become one of the creative leaders of confronting the whole COVID-19 disaster. And he's done it in a positive way of working with one of the best organizations in the country, the AAPS, the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, been president there. He's on the board there now. And then what can I say about it? I think it's founded as a Christian-based ethical journal, but it's a medical journal. And all medical journals should be ethically based. Not really, unfortunately. But it's an ethically based, it's an honorable journal here in America. And then he's gotten together with some others, and we'll talk about that. And he's a founder and a principal academic. What is that? You'll have to tell us what that is. But he's the principal academic officer at the Wellness Company. The Wellness Company. I also wonder how you ever got that name. Did you have to buy it for $1 million from somebody, the Wellness Company? Richard, welcome to the show. I really look forward to just letting you talk for a while, and I'm going to settle back.
Thank you, and it's such a great honor to be on your show, Peter. Honestly, you are such an inspiring leader, and I've looked up to you for a very long time. So I'm very happy to be with you.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you for the introduction, and you pretty much hit the high points and the low points. One of the low points, of course, when COVID hit, I was actually at that point teaching medicine down at St. George's University in Grenada, living the dream on a Caribbean island teaching these young students and trying to get them to see the beauty of medicine and the art of medicine when they were getting more or less a cookbook version of medicine. And that's one of the things that we're fighting back against now. Well, when COVID hit, everything went online, and I decided to get back to the States before they closed the island completely, which they did do. And I ended up back in my hometown in New York, and I volunteered as a nephrologist at Bellevue Hospital during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic in April through August 2020. They were overwhelmed with kidney disease, and I pitched in with some of my ancient expertise in an older technique of dialysis that they were not very familiar with. I eventually made my way back down to Grenada, had a clinic down there, and the dialysis practice, if you will, down there, very primitive, but that's what it was. The university imposed a vaccine mandate. I fought them tooth and nail, but they would not listen. They would not budge. And in July, I got put on administrative leave and ultimately terminated in January of 2022 for failing to comply with their mandate. So I ended up back in the States. I worked for a while with Simone Gold at America's Frontline Doctors. Simone, truly an incredible, inspiring person, a really modern American hero. And after a while, I decided I needed to go out on my own, if you will, with some colleagues. And that is what led to eventually the formation of what we are calling now the Wellness Company. My vision was to reinvent medicine, which has gone, as we'll discuss, seriously off the rails in so many ways, through the medium of telemedicine. I had done telemedicine for years before COVID, and it's a technique with tremendous potential. And there's very little you can't do over telemedicine. Of course, you know, some limitations, obviously. But I felt that by leveraging large numbers of doctors in a telemedicine platform, that we had a chance at starting to push back against what has been a hostile takeover of the medical profession.
Continue. I just want to hear about the story. Okay. Did you end up then with a big program of telemedicine? And is that what Wellness Company is?
Yeah, so the original plan was simply do telemedicine, but we were introduced to this brilliant entrepreneur, Foster Coulson, from Canada, from British Columbia, who had a successful career already behind him starting companies, including one with our friend Zev Zelenka, to promote his Z-Stack. So he decided he wanted to get involved in this battle, and he put his own money up to organize this company and pull it together. And I got my colleague Heather Gessling, who I've been working with for months before that, and eventually we brought in Dr. Peter McCullough, who is a very old and dear friend of mine. We go back many years. We used to meet at nephrology conferences around the world. His angle was the heart-kidney connection, and I was into the kidney, of course, and kidney-heart stuff. So we met at conferences around the world and became friends almost 20 years ago.
Oh, okay. So
and then I saw Peter come to the fore through AAPS, interestingly, right? He did his initial stuff through AAPS, which was my old organization. And we touched base again after many years and ended up now working together in the Wellness Company. So we Heather and Harvey Reich, formed the chief medical board of the Wellness Company. And our job is to pass muster on the science and make sure that we are doing things correctly and providing good recommendations and good advice. And my job specifically is as the principal or chief academic officer is the education of our physician group. So we have a group of about 100 telemedicine doctors, and we are doing weekly webinars with them. In fact, in a couple of hours, I'm going to be doing one on my approach to hypertension, which is radically different, I assure you, from the standard guideline approach to hypertension. And mine actually makes sense, and I look to reverse hypertension as opposed to treating numbers for eternity. And in fact, that's really our outlook. We want to get back to treating patients. We want to reestablish the primacy of the patient-physician relationship as the cornerstone of good medical care, which it truly is. That is where the healing is occurring. It has nothing to do with this or that medication. It's the doctor taking care of patients. That is the essence of healing. And that has been lost. There's just no question about it. So that is one aspect. We want to get away from the cookbook approach to medicine, which has become treat by numbers. The blood pressure is this, you give that. Cholesterol is this, you give that. It's reductionist, simplistic, and ultimately harmful because it does not get at the root cause of the disease. You're really just treating numbers, which are symptoms, if you will. So our approach is much more basic and fundamental, but I think much more effective. And this is what we need to get back to get medicine back on the rails, back on the track. And of course, the ethical component. We have lost any semblance of Hippocratic medical ethics. I did an article on this recently. The Hippocratic Oath has been all but abandoned in many medical schools. They've revised it many times to the point where it's unrecognizable. And if you look at the original oath, and there are many translations of it, but there's a lot in there. And if we were to get back to that, medicine would be on much firmer footing. Ethics in medicine should not be transitory. It should not be fungible. It should be eternal. It should be based on eternal truth and morality. It should not change with laws, for example, or fads. The current fad for the transgender stuff with the surgical and chemical castration of young kids is beyond unethical. The medical profession should never allow this. Doctors who are doing this should be called out as frankly just being unethical. There is no rationale for destroying perfectly good organs of these young, healthy people. It's frankly an outrage.
With you 100%, Ginger and I both with you 100%. So you've got about 100 doctors working for you. Most of them, is this part-time or full-time for them?
It varies. For some, they go at it and it's full-time. We're hoping that it will become full-time for more as our consultation volume hopefully goes up. There hopefully will be a lot of work for them and others. We're bringing in more doctors. There are a lot of doctors out there who are completely fed up, as I am, with what has become so-called mainstream medicine. And they don't want to be involved in it anymore. And this is a way for them to get out. We're not taking third-party payment. This is all just going to be cash. It's not going to be very expensive. People will be able to get really good care for not a lot. But we're not going to be dealing with insurance companies or Medicare or Medicaid. They are not going to be part of this picture. Because, of course, that's part of the problem. The medical profession, before we lost science and ethics, we also lost autonomy and control. We gave up our billing to third parties. We let them decide what our rates should be. That's an impossible situation. You cannot possibly succeed in a private practice setting where you have these third party people saying this is what we're going to pay you for that service when your costs are going up all the time. And if you can't adjust your rates to reflect that, you're going to go out of business. And that fundamentally is what happened to so many medical practices. Most doctors used to be in private practice 30 or 40 years ago. Yeah. Now only a relative handful are left in private practice. They were literally forced out by the finances and by the onerous reporting requirements that were imposed by all the payers to submit your bills. You'd get a trivial amount of money back, but you had to jump through so many hurdles to even get that. You had to hire all these people to code and bill for you. It's ridiculous. It's so expensive. This is why medicine is expensive, by the way. It has nothing to do with doctors being greedy. This is all these extra people that have to be involved for an office to run. When our operation is as streamlined as you can possibly get, and our overhead is very low. We're not renting out office space, et cetera. So we are on a course, I hope, to get medicine back where it needs to be. And it's going to be a long educational process. I hope we're going to get you involved in that at some point, because your expertise in the psychiatry arena is unparalleled. And one of our goals is to deprescribe. We're about deprescribing through.
I'm the psychiatric champ of that, for sure.
I know. So to get people off these horrible drugs, literally, is we're going to require a lot of work, but it is doable. We're going to reverse diabetes, reverse hypertension, get people healthy again, and maintain them in a state of wellness. You know, that's where the whole wellness company comes from. I had some other names, by the way, but we can discuss those later.
But it had to have been taken, wasn't it?
Yeah, there are a couple of others. I thought of quintessential medicine, which is truly what I'm looking for, what I do.
Wellness is better. You're lucky you couldn't get quintessential. Wellness is such a good title. I mean, it just covers things very, very well.
It does.
Now, what happens in this practice if somebody needs a neurological exam? Are there people who are there to do those things, or do you do them mostly on a video? How do you work with some of the tough hands-on issues?
That is to be developed. We have to establish relationships with specialists. We're in the process of doing that. And to the extent that they can function via telemedicine, that will be one way. We also will have to get involved with actual visits. You know, have to get people to see actual doctors face to face in certain circumstances. I think that there's potential to get house calls back. In fact, I think of telemedicine as a virtual house call. I love house calls. I used to do them.
Oh, wow.
Not often, but regularly, I would say. I did them down in Grenada, too. It's the best possible way to have an encounter with a patient. It really is. You get to see them in their natural habitat. There's a question about what medicines they're on. They go to the medicine cabinet, pull out their bottle of pills, and show them to you. You can actually inspect their refrigerator. I actually, at one point, patient that I was following in Grenada, lovely woman, very sick, type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, hypertension, heart failure. And I was talking to her about diet and all this stuff and how she has to avoid things like vegetable oil. And I walk into her kitchen one day and I see a huge tub of margarine on the table. And I said, oh my God, get rid of this.
Yeah,
that's the sort of thing you can do with a house call. Telemedicine is a virtual house call. You're seeing the patient in their environment. It's wonderful. It is wonderful. There are really very few limitations. Physical exam, obviously, it's going to be hard to palpate somebody or percuss their abdomen via telemedicine. But you can inspect and you can get a lot of stuff from inspection. You can get blood pressure. You can get pulse oximetry. People have these devices now. If they don't, we'll sell them to them. By the way, the wellness company also has a marketplace where we sell products, including nutritional supplements that we have made ourselves in some instances, combinations of vitamins, etc., similar to what our friend Zev Zelenko, rest his soul, did. And that's more or less what we're doing.
I love this idea of the way you put things often, you know, gives me a little better look at something. You know, the telemedicine is a home visit. And I do, a fair amount of telemedicine now. And it's interesting. In many cases, it feels more intimate than having the person in the office. And I've been thinking about that. I mean, one or two of my clients have really, who got to see me earlier, wish they could, still see me. But basically, people get more relaxed at home, I think, than in the office. But they miss, I think, some of the emotional interchange and the encouragement to have feelings and so on. But all of that does take place doing that. And I realized many, many years ago, Richard, that if I were to really conduct my practice the way I should as a psychiatrist, I should go to the home. I just knew that.
Right.
And we have studies, we have activities going on around the world where psychiatric teams, not so much with the power of the psychiatrist, but real teams, where in Finland in particular,
right,
whether you know about this, so good. So, well, you know, where people, they have a team that goes into the home,
yep,
and it treats the most disturbed people in the community, and the people in the community know about it, so they hook up their youngsters if they start to look like they're going crazy. And they come in and they look for the schizophrenia in between the people.
Right.
I love that. And it is, it's in the communications between the people. And so I really like the concept, the way you're putting it. It that's enlivening to think of it as home visit, because it's closer to a home visit than an office visit for sure.
Yeah, and assuming the technical works out, it is relaxing. And I'm talking about hypertension later on. Well, white coat hypertension is a huge problem.
Mm.
Comes into the office, they're stressed out, they just got off the subway, they ran up to catch the appointment,
mm-hmm,
their blood pressure checked and it's like 170 over 100. Is that their baseline real blood pressure? Very likely no, right? Well, you can have a patient check their blood pressure at home, and I've done this for years, of course, have patients get the home monitor, check their pressure, yeah, themselves at home, and then you get a much more accurate idea of what their baseline pressure is.
Yeah.
If doctors did this routinely, there would be far fewer prescriptions written for antihypertensive medications.
That makes a lot of sense. Again, I've not thought about it that way, but that does. It makes so much sense, and so many people have labile blood pressure, and apparently that's, you know, going up and down frequently. It's not very dangerous compared to, you know, the steady high. Am I right about that?
That's right. It's the sustained high blood pressure that is harmful. Yeah.
So it's,
and it does go up and down throughout the day. It's not, it is labile. That, I mean, it really is.
But if you're only seeing it on the ups in the office, you don't know that the pressure's been fine for hours at home. It's all very interesting. Now, I'm going to try to think of challenging problems. I mean, what happens when you want to order a scan? How do they treat you when you call up from wherever the doctor's at and says, I guess he can call in his own community, so he can make relationships in his own. But no, he can't, because he's talking on the phone to somebody God knows where. So how does that work out?
Well, we already have deals set up with labs. And we can even get labs done at home. Imaging we will do on a case-by-case basis. Obviously, it's a big part of medicine. Imaging is pretty important.
Yeah.
So we will eventually, hopefully, make deals with local imaging centers who will see patients at a reduced rate for cash and bring them into our ecosystem.
Yeah, because that's the point. They're all tied into the the insurance systems. I was wondering whether you could get any imaging centers to take cash, or how they figure out what cash, what did I, you know?
Money talks. Money
you talks. Know, you're also helping rebuild the cash society, which may turn out to be a very major contribution you make, because the more we deal in cash, so Ginger's been studying this, and we have friends that feel it's really key, having the cash, instead of doing all this stuff where you're tied to the banks and so on.
We absolutely have to get away from the whole third-party system. It is so abusive and expensive.
I ran through break. It's so interesting. But at least I heard the little bleeping warning noise in my ear and everything. Oh, this is really interesting. I hope you all are having fun looking at all this with Richard Amerling, nephrologist, internist. We'll be back soon. Well, welcome back to Refounding America and Reclaiming Ourselves. And I can't remember if I mentioned that we're on Brighty on TV. And Brighty on TV is real TV, folks. You can get it on your TV set. I'm a TV star. Roku. You know, you got to find your way around. Most TVs come with Roku now, so you can actually watch this wonderful station on Roku. And you can go to brighteon.com and get our backup, the old shows, you know, the archives, as well as the new shows as soon as they are put up. And you may be listening to me on radio today, too, because we're on radio, and that's on prn.live. Started as a radio show, I don't know, decades ago, and we're at the top 1% of the internet radio. And that's a nice thing. We're talking with Dr. Richard Amerling, and he's doing what maybe I'd like to do. Me and Ginger, next lifetime, we think we'd like to spend more time doing creative, positive things. We do them, but that's not what we're famous for. And we're famous as critics and thinkers, writers. But what I love the most of the whole health field is doing therapy, talking to people, having somebody have a conversation and actually get a better take on life. I mean, it's just an amazing, wonderful thing to do. You're inspiring me to think about, you know, what could I contribute to you? Well,
I hope so.
Well, that's lovely. I mean, that's folks, we've been talking about, you know, getting together because it's a wonderful group of people. But I've been completely independent for so long that there's nothing I can be canceled out of anymore. And it's a big change to actually think, well, and be a part of something other than the world, other than the freedom movement that we're all a part of, and the health freedom movement that we're all a part of. What would you like to pick up on now for our second segment?
Well, a couple of points. One that we mentioned before we started, which is that the capture of the medical profession by industry and government that took place over the last 30 or 40 years is what permitted the tyranny that we are now experiencing. Medical profession, typically by standing up for the rights of their individual patients, is a bulwark against governmental or other tyranny. And if doctors had stood up at the beginning of this COVID scam and said, lockdowns are insane, okay, don't do it, they can't possibly help, and they can only harm, masks we know don't work, don't do that, we don't need a vaccine for a virus that mutates like crazy, we can tell you that right off the bat, allow kids to stay in school, they are not affected by this, we could have given the direction and as a profession pushed back against the tyranny. Instead, the vast majority of doctors caved in and they followed these absurd guidelines from the National Institute of Health and the WHO, for example, saying that there's no effective treatment, patients stay home and wait until you can't breathe and then come into the hospital. This is malpractice, frankly. This should have been rejected. So the medical profession caved in and allowed this to happen. And it all comes, I believe, from the adoption years ago and the acceptance years ago of this ridiculous cult that we call evidence-based medicine, which has been completely commandeered and hijacked by people like Fauci and the NIH and the CDC to enforce a tyranny, a medical tyranny. That is exactly what we are seeing. And they, for example, can use it to their advantage. They say, look, you say hydroxychloroquine, here's a study that shows that it doesn't work. It's gone, right? In the meantime, they ignore 50 studies that show that it does. They take one crappy study of remdesivir that shows that it doesn't work, and remdesivir is now the protocol in every hospital in the country with a financial incentive to give this ineffective but very toxic drug that is literally killing people's kidneys and killing people. So that's how medical tyranny got established, by the acceptance of this notion that you can have a guideline that reflects the consensus view, right? Consensus isn't science, guys. Can reflect a consensus view of so-called experts, the vast majority of whom have financial conflicts of interest with the industry. Fauci is the king of that whole crowd. That's what the RFK book refers to as the PI, his PIs, the principal investigators. These are all these key opinion leaders that are working for pharma and that run his agenda in the real world. So that was one thing. And the other thing that we can talk about is that we need to reclaim medical education. We cannot allow what is going on in the medical schools today to continue. They are not focused on science. They're focused on social engineering, the woke agenda, the gender insanity. All this stuff is being pushed to young medical students, and they're going to come out untrained. Fundamentally, they're not going to be able to take care of sick patients, number one. And if they are, they're going to be pushing the pharma agenda, which is a pill for every ill. So one of our long-term goals is to create our own medical school.
That's a fabulous vision to have. God bless you on that one. That would be amazing. You'd have to break through that monopoly of licensure and all of that all over again. I don't know a lot about the history of that, but basically, I guess medicine threw out all the competitors and created all the licensures and took over, you know, who could call themselves a physician or whatever. And
right. Well, look, what we are facing now, look at the ridiculous law, 2098, is it, in California, that is penalizing doctors for disagreeing with the narrative. Yeah. You know, I had a conversation with a relative who's unfortunately on the wrong side of this issue. And when all was said and done, I said, well, I'm just curious. Do you approve of doctors and scientists who disagree with the current narrative being censored? He never was able to answer that question. So clearly he does. And many people do. The left is about censoring. Anything that is censored, I believe, is automatically the truth, right? If the powers that be are going after that person or that idea, then it must be true. Otherwise, they would just ignore it. So to me, it's a marker of the truth. It's sort of
That's an interesting way to think about it. It's a marker of the truth. And the other, I think an even stronger marker that the censoring side has nothing to offer.
Right. And I look at the news that way. All these young kids, these horrible, tragic stories of these young athletes in peak of condition dropping dead on the playing field. They never report in the news their vaccination status. Mm-hmm. To me, that means they were all vaccinated. Yeah. Right? It's the only possible conclusion. Because if they were not, they would report it. Right? So if they don't report it, they were. And that's how I look at the news. I'm a total contrarian. I've always been this way, but I've gone to the point where I now tell patients, if you want to be healthy, do the opposite of what the official recommendations tell you to do.
I saw the beginnings of this kind of thing in early 1990s. When the newspapers were full of stories about bizarre murders and the person was on Prozac, somebody carves up his grandmother, something really terrible, and he was on Prozac or Zoloft or Paxil, those early drugs. And the autopsies would sometimes report that they were on these drugs. And so when we did our first bestseller, Ginger and I, talking back to Prozac in 94, we had pages of newspaper reports linking violence and suicide mm-hmm. to the taking of these drugs. And it's gone now.
Right.
There's no such newspaper reporting anymore. And of course, they've come out, and I think they've tried to, in some way, I don't know how they have the authority, to outlaw autopsies for these young people who are dropping off.
That's such a great example, because it is exactly the same process, where the pharmaceutical industry has their hooks into the media, they control them, and they can make them not publish this information. It's the only explanation that I can come up with. Why else would they not mention it, right? I mean, it's relevant.
Yeah.
People want to know this stuff. It's important, yeah. even. But they never do. It has to be controlled. And it's all about keeping those sales numbers high. And these drugs, as we both know, are horrible. They do cause these horrible side effects, suicide, homicide. And why anybody with a medical degree would ever consider giving a drug to a depressed person that increases their risk of suicide is beyond me.
Thank you for saying that. This is so refreshing. You know, I had to join the freedom movement to meet people who agreed with me about psychiatry. Because it's very funny. I mean, rarely would I meet physicians who'd say, oh boy, I know your work and I love your work. But in the freedom movement, I'm commonly meeting doctors who say, oh yes, I've been following you and your wife's work for decades. It's wonderful to meet you. There's something we all have in common that believe in freedom. It's a really fundamental ethic.
It is. And I'm going to announce to the world tonight that we are going to do a psych med detox package through the wellness company with the help of you, Peter Breggin, MD, to help these very wonderful people get off of these drugs and reclaim a normal life. This is such a huge...
You've just overrode my reluctance and told me I'm going to do it, huh? This is very unusual on a TV show. All right, Richard, I'll help you with it.
Okay.
God bless you.
Very good. Very good.
Oh, Lord. I mean, it's really important that we work together. It's really very, very important. And all right, you can announce that tonight.
Okay, good. And you know, this is our focus. There is so much negativity out there, and rightfully so. I mean, we are in a horrible place in the world right now.
Oh, Lord, yes.
We have only one option, which is to fight back and to do things that are positive and that are going to have a positive impact on people. And frankly, if we don't get some semblance of a free medical profession back, there is not much of the future of mankind is bleak. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think that what you're saying about medicine, you're saying it, as I mentioned to you before the show, in kind of a better way than I have phrased it, even in the books and articles and talks I give. And that is that it really is what was done to medicine that allowed for this whole thing. And I've been focusing a lot on how, you know, World Health Organization and how WHO and medicine in general, gave us this COVID-19, should have been a farce, you know, funny play or something. It turns out to be such a tragedy with the way the medical profession does it. And this couldn't have happened. I had not thought specifically about this, Richard, till you talked about it today, that could not have happened if the AMA in particular,
yeah,
but medicine in general, hadn't just started giving up and no longer standing for freedom, for ethics, and beginning to stand up more and more for progressivism and big government and... fusing with big government, which is fascism, it's not freedom. That would have been the place to stand up, and they did, and of course they were called all kinds of names in the beginning, way back, Neanderthals and right-wingers, and boy, you can't call them that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, a handful of people did stand up and push back. Peter McCullough, our dear friend, Simone Gold, Harvey Riesch, they're heroes. Pierre Corey. I know Pierre, by the way, we're old friends too.
That's wonderful.
We worked together at Beth Israel in New York. He was in charge of the ICU there. I was a staff nephrologist there. We worked together for years. You know, interestingly, when he came out with his stand pushing ivermectin, well, I knew immediately that it worked. I don't need to see a study because I know Pierre. I know the value of the man. And I know that his integrity would never allow him to promote something that was not good, right? And that if he saw it working in actual patients that he was treating in the ICU, that was more than good enough for me to jump on the ivermectin bandwagon and endorse it. Likewise, Peter McCullough. His approach was what all doctors should have done. Use common sense, use our understanding of pathophysiology and physiology and pharmacology, and come up with something to stand in the breach and push back against this new disease. And be there for the patient. Don't abandon your patients, be there for them, even if you can't offer them anything. Hold their hand. I mean, that's what doctors did for millennia. They didn't have much in the way of therapeutics. Hold their hands. Be with them. Share your massive placebo effect, which we all know we possess. Heal them through your personal power. That's something that is not done much anymore, is it?
No, it's so interesting. You know, Jin, I've not talked about this on the air. We got a few minutes. Way back in January 2020, Ginger and I almost certainly got COVID-19. And the way it would have happened so early was, is a lot of Chinese students at Cornell, it's a lot of Chinese people at the special shops that we love to go to in town, and I had patients who were Chinese, and they actually knew enough to, when the year started and they came back, they already kind of knew enough for the second semester to, you know, quarantine, and we started talking on the phone back then. They were the ones who told me that. But we got so sick with a horrible dry cough that was so bone-racking, I was afraid it was going to crack ribs. Ginger completely lost her sense of smell and taste, which I understand is practically diagnostic. Mm-hmm. She says, I did too. I don't have as clear a memory as she's saying that we did. And it looked very much like a viral pneumonia. Nothing showed up on the scans. And our allergist, who's actually a pediatrician by training, but he's our allergist, treated us very vigorously with antibiotics, including the one that's used quite a bit, and for COVID. And he also, when we were really getting exhausted, he put us on prednisone, high doses.
Yeah,
that's half the treatment.
Right.
And then when folks, this will help you understand how malicious the government is. So when the virus comes out then, when people are trying to treat it, the FDA at one point literally said, not only do you stay home, not only do you not use antibiotics or any of these other drugs, they weren't just outlawing particularly ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. They're also saying, you know, antibiotics don't work. They weren't as nasty about them, but they don't work when they do work if you get a secondary infection. And then they said, no, prednisone, can't use prednisone. Remember that?
Yeah.
That was the craziest thing. And it showed the maliciousness that they were trying to rob us all of treatment, force us into the hospitals, and force us to wait for the vaccines. Just unbelievable.
And of course, the overarching point is that no government agency or authority should dictate practice to individual physicians. Every physician must be autonomous and be able to practice according to the best of his ability and judgment. And had that system still been in place, we would have stopped this in its tracks. But doctors were literally prevented, and barriers were put up to prevent them from doing real medicine to the detriment of probably millions of people who died unnecessarily. Yeah. It's a crime of the century.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But you're doing really good things, and I think that's very exciting. Do you have many psychiatrists doing telemedicine?
We have one now.
Well, I don't know if I'm not doing telemedicine with you, but we're working together here.
Yeah.
You're very sweet. It's very kind of you.
We have one or two And, you know, we're expanding. We're going to eventually have all the specialties. We're eventually going to have what I view as a medical faculty. That will be the core of the medical school. We're setting up this practice like an academic medical practice that you would have in a major medical center with divisions, chairs, et cetera. We have Harvey Riesch, chief of epidemiology, for example. What a great guy. And Peter's in charge of cardiology. Okay, we have COVIDology as a new discipline. You'll be the chair of psychiatry, and we'll bring psychiatry back to where it ought to be. And we were at the AAPS meeting, Heather Gessling and I, and we ran into these MDs who have graduated medical school, but who could not.
We got 1 minute.
Okay, they could not match in a residency program. So that's maybe a pool of people that we can tap into to bring in, and we'll create a little residency program for them in real medicine.
Yeah. Well, I have always wanted to develop a program for teaching psychotherapy. You know, I've done a teaching film, and I think somewhere there are 20, I've done 20 videos for Pam Popper with, we used to do a program.
Right.
So maybe, I said we wanted to next lifetime around do more of the creative positive side. Maybe we'll do it now.
Sounds good. Let's not wait.
Thank you so much. Oh my gosh, Richard, it's wonderful. I feel like I'm actually getting to meet you more than previously on the show. That's one of the reasons I love doing the show.
Likewise.
Yeah, that's really. Do you do a TV show or a radio show of any kind?
No. No,
let me know if you would like to. I know lots of folks.
Yeah, you bet. That sounds great.
Yeah, I'd love to help you do that.
Okay,
okay, Richard Amerling, thank you so much. Thank you, and thank you for your wellness group. That was just wonderful.